Radio.
Understanding a Secular Age. A talk by Father Richard Umbers for the Dawson Society of Philosophy and Culture of Perth, Western Australia.
Great, a very diverse audience. I was trying to think how I would pitch it. But anyway, if I see people ordering extra beers, I'll know I'm probably putting it a little too high, but I want to talk about secularism, understanding what that is and how that impacts on us. And I think when we look at the technological revolution of the internet, because it is a technological revolution, here we have talking about technology for... Is it Alex? Yeah. You wanted me to mention technology, but there's the prop. Ideas have spread so rapidly, and you find various intellectual communities in such variety that we ourselves are beginning to notice that change. Normally, the change is only seen over the course of many generations. And you look back, you know, after 200 years, and you could say, ah, yes, now I can see why people thought that way. But the pace of change now is so great that even in our own lifetimes, we can see the change. You don't have to wait centuries to see the difference. If you compare the general attitude of people, say, from the Great Depression to people who are under 18 today, compare the two. And I'll mention some issues and think what the reaction would be from people from the Depression years and people from today who are still at school. Aboriginal spirituality. Gay marriage. Transgender. In fact, I think people from the Depression era years would go, trans what? Christianity. Very different reactions at a generational level. Significantly different reactions. And I don't know, how many of you have seen Twitter or use Twitter? A few people on Twitter, a few tweeters. Okay, there. Tweet some tweeters down there. Okay, I'm a Twitter addict. I just can't help myself. I'm always on Twitter. I've given up a number of times. It's like, you know, but always sort of relapse back into Twitter again. But I see there journalists, politicians, academics, people who shape the way we think. And they have, in their public conversation, though, it's replete with totems and shibboleths and tribal insults. And you'll see there, you know, things like, you know, social justice warrior, or, well, you're a right-wing nut job, well, you're a prog, you're a white supremacist, you're a tanky. All these different terms, which are sort of tribal affiliation, you know, them and us, in-group and out-group. It's always been that way. But perhaps the difference today, as opposed to other times, is that you can choose which tribe you want to belong to online. And as technology increases apace, we all have any number of what is known as transhuman positions. We are talking about transhumanism now because of technology, where you look for super intelligence, super longevity, super well-being. In a sense, this is a way of looking for the good and the true and the beautiful, but within a horizon that is purely of this world, an imminent horizon. And that's what secularism is about. And in the midst, then, of so much material progress that we have made over these centuries, there is nevertheless this postmodern feeling of being disoriented about our identity. Who are we, really? And when you look at transhumanism, that really throws that into relief. Everything you took for granted is now turned upside down because of what technology makes possible. I was reading an article on Twitter today by a transsexual academic speaking about Germaine Greer, in defense of Germaine Greer, in having a go at Caitlyn Jenner. And I mean, you have all these sorts of intersectional battles between, well, feminists of the old school and well, men who now call themselves women in another school, and how that all works out. And the mind boggles. There's great confusion over our identity. What is it that makes us human? Who are we? And as a result of that, we have in these last few centuries what you might call a cross stream. In the one hand, you have this growing disbelief in the Bible, in religion, a drop-off in church practice. People feel, I'm not saying that they've got necessarily good reasons, but they feel that it's not credible. But at the same time, you've got this other stream going of nostalgia for something more deep, something more spiritual. Because what we find in everyday life is something quite bland, one-dimensional. We have technology, we have entertainment, we have shopping, we have work. But it's a one-dimensional life. Because without religious belief, our language loses its poetic power to name things embedded in a higher reality. An example of this would be, how many of you have seen that movie, Shaun of the Dead? Have you seen Hot Fuzz? You've seen Hot Fuzz. Well, Shaun of the Dead, the same guys. Shaun of the Dead. In Shaun of the Dead, what's so funny about it, as a spoof, is that there's a zombie apocalypse. And what makes it humorous is that there's no significant difference before the zombie apocalypse and after the zombie apocalypse. People are the same. They're doing the same things. Their lives are no different, whether they're zombies or not. We want to believe, but we find ourselves in a world that does not speak to us of the divine. At best, we can play at being Jedi Knights, queue up to purchase Star Wars paraphernalia for the latest installment. I don't know if you've been looking at the trailers. There's another trailer. They've photoshopped Jar Jar Binks as the main character for everything. But that's what it means to live in a secular age. This is the secular age that we live in. Okay, so how do we then as Christians relate to a secular world, if this is our world? When does the God of Abraham make some kind of impact in the public space and in politics? What are we to take as our political stance in this kind of a world? And there are various options. I mean, you could, branch stack the local Liberal branch, the Liberals. So you could throw your energy into the DLP, if they're still around. You could bunker down with what's called the Benedict option and wait for the new age. There's a growing tribal affiliation even within the kind of Catholic ghettos that we're forming. I don't know about Perth, but in Sydney at least anyway, you see a number of younger people with their own totems and shibboleths, that mark someone out. You're a Neocat. Well, I'm a Caro. Well, you're Opus Dei. You're a Traddie. I'm a dolphin hugger. forms of tribal identity. I don't know that I'm going to give you necessarily a definitive answer on this, but what I want to do, and here's my, product placement. I don't stand to make any money out of it, but this is a book called A Secular Age by Charles Taylor. It is a big book. I've seen it on the shelf so long, and I thought, well, look, I need to read this book. It cost me blood to read this thing. Still about a couple hundred pages shy, to tell the truth. But at least anyway, giving a talk tonight helped me to get through this book. It's an important book. It's one of the most important ones to be written in the last while. If you like reading, if you have an opportunity, do read this book. It really puts you in the picture. Charles Taylor is a Catholic philosopher who's written other big tomes like that called Sources of the Self, amongst other things. He's now in his mid-80s. But what he does is show you how fragile and how contingent any particular social equilibrium really is. What I'll do, and I'll see how quickly I do this, is trace what's known as a genealogy, from the Middle Ages through to which was known as an age of belief, through the birth of our modern society, the age of the world as an image, and then down to our own rejection of the Enlightenment. The reason I'll do this and the reason why he writes this book is to show us that there's nothing necessary about the way we live today. Because there are stories that we tell ourselves, and I'll talk more about those, where we say, well, once science arises, this is necessarily the kind of society that you would live in. And that's not true. But before I do that, let's talk a little bit about the term secular, because it has different meanings. In one sense, if you look at the French Revolution, you could talk about, if I pronounce this right, my French is terrible, but laïcité. You know, you have a separation of church and state. So you know that when you get married in France, for instance, you have a civil wedding, and then you have to go along and have a separate religious wedding. We may come to that here in Australia. I wouldn't mind, because I hate doing all the paperwork for the government. A second sense is what's known as anti-theism. It's the kind of Richard Dawkins stuff, where you have the new atheists sort of, you know, who are aggressively against any kind of religious belief. A third sense of secularism is what you might term scientific naturalism. It's like a default option. Look, this is just how the world is. You've got physics, and that's pretty much it. And a fourth sense, perhaps one that's more Catholic, is to think about, well, all those things that concern the present age, as opposed to some higher time that rules all ages. You know, we say that in the Gloria Patri, you know, in secula seculorum, that age of all ages. But following Charles Taylor, I want to talk about the third meaning. That one where we see the secular as just being common sense. How is it that we went from a society, say in 1500, that was deeply religious, a world of spirits, of community prayer? Atheism was not even thinkable for the majority of people in that society. To one where religion now is just one option among many, and it's not a very popular one either. As I said before, the common account that people have is what you might call a subtraction story. What they say is, well, look, you've got, we're human beings, we've got human values, just get rid of the superstition, and you end up with the society we have today, secular humanism. Just, you know, just add science and poof, there you go, this is what you get. Take away the constraints of dogma and prejudice, you get progress. It's like a moving idea in the world, where we worry more about getting the state to acquire the situation of our well-being, you know, well-being here and now, rather than worry about heaven. And in doing so, we talk about, in general, a kind of historical understanding. We say that we live now in an age of reason and light, as opposed to an age of myth and irrational belief. People say, get with the times. They say, this is 2015. They'll say to you, do you want to take us back to the 50s? They'll say, do you want to take us back to the Middle Ages? So on this account, what I'd call a subtraction account, just take away religion and then you're left with science, you're left with, you know, rational belief. On that account, a very popular one, in the near future, religion will simply be the preserve of people who can't be bothered to Google on science, or who have fallen into the trance of some kind of sect. Religion will be the preserve of kooks. If you started society from scratch, you'd end up more or less with a few outliers, and that's what religion is. This is a very popular account of where things are going. It's popular, maybe, but that does not square with the reality of what has happened. Because the way in which we see the world, the way in which we socially construct the world, what Charles Taylor calls a social imaginary, is different today as opposed to then. We feel the world in a different way to how they did then. And that's why what we need to look at with this book is that Taylor is setting out the conditions for belief, what is in the background to our beliefs, what seems like common sense, in a word, which has changed. If we're Christians, and as Christian believers, when we seek fullness in our life, we seek it in God. God who reveals himself to us, God who reveals him to who is received by us personally. That's our understanding, that's our background understanding. But if you're a non-believer, and typically, you know, what you have from the Enlightenment is someone who... Have you heard of Immanuel Kant? Many of you have heard of Immanuel Kant. Well, a kind of Kantian rationality where it's about pure reason, the critique of pure reason. And so it's about something autodidactic, where reason is its own support. And we get rid of authority. We have religion within the bounds of reason. That's a very Kantian way of looking at things. Or, even amongst unbelievers, you can have a critique of the Enlightenment. Because reason, which is used as the standard, as the bar by Kant, to judge everything else, including tradition and society and religion, you know, reason is the bar. In questioning everything, reason then starts to question itself. And it sees that reason is not as reasonable as was supposed. And then you have perhaps ideas of ecological unity, communing with nature, you know, sort of romantic notions. And then you have other unbelievers who just say, look, the world is broken and that's just the way things are. We're all broken, but there's no repair. It's a very nihilistic kind of postmodernism. What is it that distinguishes these unbelievers from ourselves as believers? It's that sense of it's transcendence. We seek a transcendent God. They seek fullness in an immanent way, in a secular way, in a way that does not involve going outside of this world. What marks our age then, in this case, where you have believers and unbelievers of different sorts, different stripes, is this plurality of positions. And that means that we live in an age of doubt. As Christians, we doubt, but as unbelievers, they doubt too. Because we know that rational people lay claim to these different positions. And you're always looking over your shoulder and thinking, well, that person's reasonable. Why do they believe differently to me? And unbelievers say the same things to themselves. They say, well, if you're a reasonable person, why are you a believer and I'm not? And they wonder about that. There's doubt. That is a way of viewing the world, experiencing the world, that is incredibly different, very different to how people did 500, 800 years ago. Have you ever been to the Prado in Spain? Anyone been there? Have you seen Jerónimo Bosch? He's a weird, weird painter. He does these images of hell that look like they're surreal. Look him up. He's a real weirdo. Fantastic paintings. For us, we look at it and go, "What is that?" You know. But for the people at that time, those weren't just objects. They weren't just theories. That was like what they expected. Spiritual matters weren't beliefs to be discussed. They were facts about the world. And so there's a big distancing then from how people experienced a world of spirits, a world in which everything spoke to you of God, to the world we have today, where everything has been medicalized, objectified, distanced, made mathematical. In a sense, we live via an age where the world has become an image that we can break down and reformulate and manipulate according to our own interests. We see the world as mathematical, a mathematics that breaks everything down and can be reformulated, re-engineered. Think about how transhumanists speak of our bodies now. Certainly not as a gift from God. Where did it all begin? Well, according to Charles Taylor, it began in the 1200s. This reform in society, this movement of Saint Dominic and Saint Francis. They sought reform in a society that had, until that time, been structured around monks who prayed, soldiers who fought, and lay people that defended them. Sorry, and lay people who sustained the monks and the soldiers that were defending them. You know, in Latin, you could have oratores, bellatores, and laboratores. Those who pray, those who fight, those who work. And any disturbance against this order had cosmic effects. Now, plot spoiler here for Shakespeare, but Duncan's murder is accompanied by various strange happenings in nature. You know, even in the 17th century, early 17th century, Shakespeare could still allude to that kind of an understanding. Whereas for us today, why would the assassination of a king have any kind of impact upon, you know, hawks or the clouds or anything like that? I mean, there's no relationship. In the society that I'm talking about in the past, people had what Charles Taylor calls a porous self. A self that could be impacted on under the influence of spells and enchantment, and by the same token, also the, you know, if you want it in inverted commas, the white magic of the church, in sacraments and saints' relics that were able to ward off the bad magic. That's how people viewed the world. That's how they experienced it. And so when you had a calamity, it was not a test of faith. You still see this, for instance, in the Philippines. I was in Tacloban a year ago. And in Tacloban, the previous year, there had been a great typhoon. And it had wiped out various areas, you know, because of the storm surge. It was like a tidal wave. And thousands of people got swept out to sea and were drowned. And I went to visit San Jose. It was just devastating. I spoke to the parish priest there. He had an amazing story to tell about being taken up. He was praying the rosary with some altar boys. And the water came in and they got taken up to the second floor of the church. And he had to sort of throw the altar boys into the beams, you know, to get to safety. And thankfully, they were there. But when they came down again, you know, most of the village had just been wiped out. And he found a little suitcase there with a mass kit, and then he opened it up and began to say mass. And then those who survived came around and they began to pray. And priests told me that they had a procession only a few weeks after that, where these thousands of people had died. And they had a procession around the place. And normally, I mean, I took part in some processions while they were there. I mean, they love having a procession. Even in the midst of, you know, gale force winds and everything, you have the procession and do it, you know, with the band and the fireworks and the whole thing. And they had this procession. And the place was packed with the survivors, and they were on their knees crying. Faith was not diminished. Faith was augmented by what had happened. Compare that to how we would respond to anything remotely similar. We would be shaken in our faith. You see the difference in society, and the same happened in Europe. You look at what happened in the 1700s. In 1755, there was that great earthquake in Lisbon. The people were not restored to faith after that. If anything, at least from French authors like Voltaire, they wrote about it and said, well, look, you know, if there's a good God, if God's benevolent, why would he let this happen? There's a change in the society that makes people reason in this way. So with these Dominicans and with these Franciscans, what they began to do was to shake things up. They wanted reform. They wanted people to improve themselves, to think about heaven, to think about their own particular judgment. And along with that, so that it wasn't just for the monks, it was for everybody. And they're called to holiness. Everyone's called to holiness. Everyone's called to heaven. And the fourth letter in council in 1215 made certain prescriptions for everybody, for all Catholics. You know, you all have to go to confession at least once a year during Easter, because you all have to go to communion at least once a year. There were some minimum standards. Everybody's being brought along. Is a general raising of the bar. Now, why does this matter? Because what it does is it says to everybody, hey, we all have to improve. I'll explain how this then works its way out. So because what it does is it says to people, a bit like Obama, yes, we can. And that changed things for people. Until then, you had this hierarchical order. Things were as they were. You had the king, you had the monks, we tilled the soil, and this is the way it was, and this is the way it's going to be. And those who you had certain people who were elites, and you had others like, they're just going to be who they're going to be. But now there's something different. Yes, we can make a difference. In one of those societies, in sort of medieval society, you used to have carnival. And carnival is like an upturning of order. So, you know, a classic thing in monasteries would be that the youngest monk or the, you know, would then take the place of the superior for the day and give people orders. Or, you know, in the cathedral, say, you'd have an altar boy and he'd sit where the bishop is and start, you know, giving commands. And people would turn things upside down. But in making fun of these things, it's been like a bit of an outlet of the tension. It was still reinforcing the fact that, yes, there is such a hierarchy during the rest of the year. What we have now with this reforming influence is the idea that, well, look, no, there is a better way to be, and we're not going to have a carnival, we're not going to have a break from this, because this is the way it should be. There's no reason for us to have that break, that tension broken. We're going to reform. And you had this notion of self-improvement away from the community. You would read the scripture on your own. You would undertake a devotion to the Sacred Heart on your own. You would get spiritual direction. You'd think about the particular judgment. It's true. With purgatory, there were sodalities. People would then band together in new ways to pray for the dead. But what you have is this reform of the self, and then it leads into other areas as well. And you had an understanding of etiquette and of being polite, politesse. You know, you had these incredible works of etiquette where they tell you, look, it's not polite to blow your nose on the tablecloth. You shouldn't pick up some poo and point it out to your companion. these are the works of etiquette that they had. And you think, oh my goodness, you know, what was going on? But so there's an idea of civilization and a civilizing force. Now, the problem is that with this idea of reform and of civilizing, people begin to identify Christianity and the gospel with the civilizing force itself. And I'll explain why later, why that's a problem. I've got a whole section here on philosophy. I'm going to skip it. So I'm sorry, you wanted me to talk about Blessed Duns Scotus. Very important, but I'm not going to go into it. There we go. So jumping all of that. Unless you really, really want me to talk about univocity of being versus the analogia entis. No? No, okay, I didn't think. So what happened, though, with those various reforms is that there was a pushback. Because people feared making an unworthy communion, as we should. I mean, look at Paul to the Corinthians. He says as much, but because of these minimum requirements, people began to think, well, look, it's just the way of things. Even when there's a minimum requirement, people still don't meet it. And so instead of going to confession, because you need to do that to get to communion, what they would do is they say, well, look, in order just to get some kind of grace, even at a distance, that when the priest elevated the host, they'd sort of drop into the church, see the priest raise the host, and go, higher, higher. You know, they could see it, great, I've seen our Lord, I get grace from that, okay, I'm off. That's my attendance at Mass. Now, that's an abuse. Every age has its abuses. Every age has its problems. Every age has its lack of catechesis. And in the midst of that kind of, you know, popular understanding, which was incorrect, but still it was there, you then had these reformers, these proto-reformers like the Waldensians and the Lollards, and they began to push back in a very iconoclastic, heretical way. And they would have a go at the priests, and they'd have a go at the sacraments. They would really attack the white magic of the church's sacraments. You know, how could the sacraments confer grace ex opere operato if the priest was a bad man? Or under the influence of Duns Scotus and William of Ockham and others, you know, how could the sacraments bind God? I mean, God's all powerful. What's the go here? So they began to push against the understanding of sacraments or of the church. And then you had Luther. Then you had the real Reformation. And he began to really up the ante on this sort of pushback. When he tapped into people's fears about the end of time, about their own judgment. So the priests, the mendicant monks, the friars had been preaching about your particular examination of your particular judgment, you know, think about death, remember death, memento mori. Well, tapping into that vein of preaching, Luther then said, well, yeah, think about death. You're not going to make it. You're not going to be able to reach it there. Just have faith, faith alone. And people said, yeah, okay, great. So I want salvation. I'm really concerned about salvation. I don't seem to be getting there. But hey, this thing, if I just have faith, if I just say Jesus, I'm saved. Yeah, I'm in for that. And then you had Calvin preaching that juridical concern that had arisen because, you know, during the Middle Ages, they had, sort of, in a sense, rediscovered Roman law. And that entered into theology, and it was very legalistic. And there wasn't as much emphasis on the mercy of God and grace. And so Calvin, who was a Catholic priest, but then left the faith and formed his own way of looking at these things. He even had his own little catechism. It's quite funny reading through those things. He's, you know, beware those Catholics. He rails against the blasphemy of the church's white magic because all magic is of the devil. Again, look, the sacraments, by the way, are not magic. That's a misunderstanding of the sacraments. But in the sort of what we're talking about here is popular imagination, which is not well catechized. And because they were having a go at the pride of these monks, these spiritual elites, these celibates who were different to the people, they said, no, we're all the same. We're all the same. They then had to sort of raise the level for everybody, and everyone had to live a stricter life of renunciation. There was Puritanism. You know, not allowed to have fun. Come on, you know, enough drinking there. You know, let's see, you know, go do your prayers. But what came with that, perhaps, was a certain pride in our own abilities to set our own life in order and to set the world in order. But without the sacred, without grace, without the bonds that come from being in a particular time, in a particular church. And there was this understanding that grew that we could successfully reorder the world in this age, in this seculum. And it so coincided at that time that you had the rise of modern science, where there was no longer a concern for Aristotelian ends, but simply efficient causality alone, Baconian science. This mechanization of the world picture, it coincided with that. These things, I've lost you all, but anyway, these things all came together at a particular time when you had the Reformation, you had wars of religion that were bitter. You had the 30 Years' War, which was a horrible, all war is horrible, but those wars were particularly horrible. And emerging from that, the elites were concerned, this idea of etiquette, of politesse, of civilization. They say, look, can't we all just get along, can't we just agree on certain aspects? What do we all have in common? We all want order. We all want reform. We all want to be better. Let's just talk about those things. And you had now a push that wasn't exactly Christian, but rather Stoic, a neo-Stoicism. Christianity was born with an understanding of fullness, with an understanding of if you follow God, you'll be happy. But at the same time, there's a tension in that because also you know that in Christianity there is an understanding of the cross. Yes, you'll be happy, but also you will suffer. And the two are never fully reconciled with each other. But in Stoicism, the two collapse into each other. You become so indifferent, in a sense, to the things around you that you should always be happy, regardless of fortune. And this understanding was very present in certain key people, like Justus Lipsius, who's a fellow I hadn't heard about until I'd read this book, but he was a key figure in all of this with the Neo-Stoicism. What happened is that in the countries that were around, with these new princes, these new sort of nation, the growings of nation states, and that with order, with commerce, they began to understand that in being able to change society and to change it for the better and to do these things, that there was an understanding that, look, if we got our people to be better, they would be more efficient soldiers, they would be more efficient in bringing in tax revenue and in trade. We can get more wealth. Where you had in the Middle Ages this concern to worship God, and then you had this reform in the Catholics, but also with the Protestants, you had a shift in activity now, no longer so much as in the worship of God as in reform of self. For the worship of God, but it became about what we do. No longer for God, but for ourselves. And that's how this secular humanism began to take shape. Now, Charles Taylor calls it a zig of neo-Stoicism. What comes afterwards is the zag, you get a zigzag, of deism. Providential deism, but impersonal order, the kind of Freemasonry that you see in the French Revolution, where it's no longer so much about pleasing a personal God or worshipping a personal God, it's about discovering the order of things. God is the great architect who's made this order. He sort of made the world and kicked, you know, sort of, and then left it alone, and it follows these laws. And if we tap into that, we can be prosperous. There's a, you know, do the right thing, you'll get the money. Prosperity gospel kind of stuff, but in a very impersonal way. And in doing so, Carnival was killed. This is real Puritanism. But a Puritanism that now led into the French Revolution, that led into this critique that was no longer, you know, what the Protestants had been saying against the Catholics about, you know, the magic and all these things. Now, you had people who were concerned about the impersonal order of things and making those same criticisms against Christians in general. You had a disciplined society that was concerned about this world and this world alone, our own efforts in this world, in an impersonal order, an impersonal God. What had begun as an order for reform ended up in something corrupt. It began from Christianity, but ended up as a corrupt fruit of Christianity. You ended up with a state, and we have this today with us. The church would, in the past, look after the poor and the hungry, shelter, food, in the glory of God, as a work of mercy. But through this order of reform in society, and you had poor laws, the state, little by little, took over all of these things and began to become a form of savior. It began to administer its own sacraments for this life. And you started to have a social welfare society administered by the state, taking the place of some kind of malformed Christianity. This is what we have today. There's a fellow by the name of Ivan Illich, who's kind of like the radical person's radical person, who makes a reflection on the Good Samaritan story and showing we've got the wrong end of the stick with it. Because what it's about is our own efforts, the work of reform by men on behalf of God is now taking precedence over the worship of God. It's about human effort, it's not about grace. It's about confidence in our own abilities. It's that, yes, we can. And the thing is, we could. We could. That's what made it so attractive. The thing is, of course, today, we realize more and more, well, we can't. Because of pollution, because of breakdown in the family. Because when Christianity has withered away, when we've got rid of religion, certain problems still remain because they're human defects. And we live in a society that has the technology and has the material things but doesn't have a sense of the transcendent that is a longing in all of us. We have social welfare, but we don't have agape. Where does that bring us today? I've cut out a lot of things from the talk because otherwise I'd be here all night, but so I've basically, it feels like I've been a bit rushed. It has been. But that's a 760-page book. Okay. So now I've sort of get to the last part of the talk. You can say, oh, thank goodness. Where is the battleground for Christian endeavor in a secular society where the state has taken over the role of the church? Should we be combating in the political arena, you know, that political correctness that we see with progressives? What does that mean? When we fight to preserve the status quo, what is the status quo that we are preserving? I would suggest many times it's a status quo that was only here 10 years ago. We're forever fighting a battle of... think about when The Simpsons first came out. And we were all saying, oh, The Simpsons, that's terrible. Kids, don't watch this stuff. And then South Park came out. You go, kids, don't watch that. Watch The Simpsons. I don't think we've quite got to the stage where we say, yeah, South Park's fine, it's all cool and dandy. But, you know, but The Simpsons now is like, meh, nothing. Compared to what other stuff you get, you know. Think of Hillary Clinton. Have you seen her speech in 2004 about marriage? YouTube it. Her speech, Hillary Clinton, 2004, gay marriage. Unbelievable. You would agree with every word she says. And she says, I believe, you know, and I take umbrage at the fact that people would question my belief that, you know, marriage is between a man and a woman, it's a sacred bond, and socializing children has been like that since the mists of time. All the things, you go, I can't believe you're saying this. And now see Hillary Clinton, 2015, Ellen Show, all the... I thought 10 years ago you said you believe it. Well, maybe she did, but you know, these are her principles, and if you don't like them, she's got some others. But if we had the technology, would we do a reverse of Terminator and send Hillary 2004 to sort of campaign against Hillary 2015? Is that going to solve our problems? You know, there's something in what Dostoevsky writes with his Grand Inquisitor. You know, where he has people, the Grand Inquisitor's, you know, questioning Jesus. And he says, you know, you've got all these, it's a grand soliloquy. You've caused all these problems. You know, we know what's best. And the Grand Inquisitor's like an atheist. And he says, what people need, they need a dictator to tell them what to do with their freedom. They don't know. They can't do it themselves. We've got to tell them what to do. Sometimes that can be lurking there in our own efforts to reform. What we can't do is confuse the church or the gospel with the reasoning of modernity. Pope Benedict would often say, you know, reason has a wax nose. What does he mean by that? Well, a wax nose can be shaped in different ways. And what we think is reasonable really many times pertains to a particular cultural period of what we love. You know, we talk about marriage, but marriage without Jesus Christ can sometimes be a fairly brutish affair. But marriage with Christ, when we study the Gospels, when we study, you know, theology of the body, we realize the erotic can be directed to the fullness of love of God. You know, that's what Christian marriage is. There's a difference. The incarnation makes a difference. Jesus makes a difference. And we need to talk about Jesus as Christians. And I find in my own work, the more I talk about the Trinity and the more I talk about Jesus, the more people listen. I can talk about natural reason. I can go through, you know, in a way, what we all have in common. And it's not the same. We can't hearken back to some golden age per se, because there never really has been one. We are wayfarers in the world. Even if we had a Catholic society, we would still, if we were truly Christians, truly living the faith as Catholics, we'd still be wayfarers. We'd still be a little bit awkward, because the saints are awkward. The saints are uncomfortable. The saints never really kind of fit. And what we need is that search for sanctity with grace, which is a personal response. If not, it's almost inevitable that you will have, even in the best of movements, a party that will seek power for its own benefit. As Charles, and I'm saying this correct, Piguet, I can't pronounce his name, you know, P-E-G-U-Y, Piguet, I think. He says, what begins with mystique ends up in politique. So what we need then is it an appreciation of the communion of saints. What is the right thing to do in each age? Well, that's up to us, if we are seeking sanctity. Because each age, each seculum, has to be sanctified by its own age. We can't go back to the past and relive that past, because it's a different age. There's a different way of seeing that age. History is bound up in that. Even in the Middle Ages, they had their own understanding of having left paganism behind. We have the past with us, but we have to sanctify this time. People in the future will be sanctifying their own. It's not about doing away with the past, it's always with us. And we're called to continually reform on the basis of what the gospel says, but in our own way. Because memory, and we have memory in the liturgy, memory is putting yourself there, it's living the experience once again. To historicize something is to sort of run alongside it. It's to objectify it. It's to put it at a distance and say, this is what it was. So when we live the liturgy, for instance, you know, I celebrate the Novus Ordo Mass, but I know how to celebrate the Tridentine Mass, the Extraordinary Four. It cost me blood to learn it because there's so many rubrics, but it's beautiful. I love it. But I know that what matters is not so much sort of like to getting a photo snapshot of now I'm doing this and now I'm doing that. It's the spirit behind it. It's the contemplation. It's the prayer. It's the love of God. Not being too busy trying to imitate this, and now I have to do it that way, and now I have to do it that way. I mean, I should know that, but it has to flow. There's a liturgical way of moving. And you can see that. When a priest says Mass, you know how much he's been praying beforehand. You can see it in the way he celebrates the Mass. Sanctity. And Charles Peguy, who's an interesting kind of guy, he talks about saints who know they are sinners. The sinner extends his hand to the saint, since the saint reaches out to help him. And altogether, the one through the other, they form a chain that rises up to Jesus, a chain of fingers that can't be disconnected. The one who is not Christian is the one who does not offer his hand. There's a sense of community. We're all needed. But what kind of community? What kind of values? As we are. But seeking to look forward, to look to the example of Jesus Christ. And that will take different forms in different countries and different places at different times. What matters is the people. That's why the Pope Francis is always saying, people before ideas. A living tradition. Sanctifying our own seculum. Other ages contend with theirs. And that's why, for people like Gerald Manley Hopkins, he was very aware. He, in a sense, converted to Christianity in an age that was very far from Christianity, as is our own. Because what he saw in Christianity was not this reform or order or moral rules or impersonal order. What he saw was a communion with the love of God. So this is the way of I suppose, contending with what is missing in our secular age. Communion, where the individual differences, the particularity of others, is brought together in a union that is based on Jesus in the Eucharist. There's solidarity, there's a respect, without the tribalism, without the totems, without demonization of the outgroup. Separate people are brought together across time and space in the body of Christ. And we know that our love for the Mass, our imitation of what we celebrate in the Mass, means that we will not be free of the cross. There's no cheap grace. The cross will always be present. It's not like, previous times I thought, oh, this is a breeze. All we have to do is this and then it's all okay. No, we know it won't be like that. Not if we're celebrating Mass, not if we're participating in the Mass. We realize we're called to lay down our life for the world in this seculum. But in that way, we're able to really to live a Christianity that's not identified with a particular historical age. We're present in every age. And there I finish.
That was Father Richard Umbers with Understanding a Secular Age. This talk was a production of the Dawson Society for Philosophy and Culture of Perth, Western Australia. For more information and for similar lectures, please visit their website at dawsonsociety.com.au and like them on Facebook. And for more talks, interviews and shows, visit cradio.org.au.